Sometimes the vision appears during the period of meditation, but at other times it is seen while the observer is busy about his ordinary affairs. A Lama Tsepa told me that once when taking his meal he saw a Jayad Lama. Lama Tsepa is an astrologer. Jayad Lama, a fellow of a college of magic ritual, friend of his whom he had not met for several years. The Jayad Lama stood at the door of his house side by side with a young tripper, who carried a small load on his back, as if ready to start on a journey. The traveler bowed his farewell at the feet of the Lama and then the latter smilingly spoke a few words and pointed with his hand towards the north. The tripper turned in that direction and bowed down again thrice. As he got up, he arranged his monastic toga more tidily and the Tsepa noticed that it was badly torn at one end. After this, the vision vanished. A few weeks later, the same young man whom he had seen, arrived from the Gind Lama, who wished him to be taught some astrological calculations. The tripa related that, when taking leave of his former teacher, after he bowed to him, the latter said, "As you are now going to your new master, you had better bow down to him also." And he had pointed towards the north, the Tsepa's dwelling being situated in that direction. The Lama also noticed a large rent in his pupil's toga, which he had already seen in his vision. I inquired if the Jayad Lama had meant to convey to his friend the news that he was sending him the young tripper. No answer could be given to my question, because the event was recent, and since it happened, the Tsepa had had no opportunities of dispatching a message to the Jayad Lama. I may add that the average Tibetans are much less eager than we are to investigate psychic phenomena. They take them as certainly uncommon, but not altogether extraordinary occurrences. They have no fixed ideas about the laws of nature or what is possible and impossible, to be disturbed by such phenomena. Educated or ignorant, all implicitly admit that everything is possible to him who knows the way of doing it, and consequently supernormal feats do not, as a rule, awaken any special emotion beyond admiration for the competent wonder worker. Chapter 7, Mystic Theories and Spiritual Training. The religious world in Tibet, generally speaking, is divided into two sections. The first includes those who advocate the strict observance of moral precepts and monastic rules as the means of salvation. The second is formed of those who prefer an intellectual method which frees its followers from all laws whatsoever. Nevertheless, there exists no rigid division between these two categories. Though their respective theories are always a favorite subject of controversy between the followers of the two schools, it seldom happens that one stands in the position of a harsh, pugnacious adversary towards those in the opposite camp. Even the monks attached to morality acknowledge that a virtuous life and the monastic discipline, though of great value and advisable for the many, are but a mere preparation to a higher path. As for the adepts of the second system, they all believe in the beneficial results of a faithful adherence to the moral laws and the rules laid down for members of the religious order. Moreover, all are unanimous in declaring the first method the safer of the two. A pure life, the performance of good deeds, righteousness, compassion, detachment from worldly cares, selflessness and quietness of mind act, they say, as a cleansing process which gradually removes the impure dust that covers the mental eyes. As for the method which mystics call the short path, the direct path, it is considered as most hazardous. It is, according to the masters who teach it, as if instead of following the road which goes round a mountain ascending gradually towards its summit, one attempted to reach it in straight line, climbing perpendicular rocks and crossing chasms on a rope. Only first-rate equilibrists, exceptional athletes, completely free from giddiness, can hope to succeed in such a task. Even the fittest may fear sudden exhaustion or dizziness. And there inevitably follows a dreadful fall in which the too presumptuous alpinist breaks his bones. By this illustration, Tibetan mystics mean a spiritual fall leading to the lowest and worst degree of aberration and perversity, to the condition of a demon. I have heard a learned Lama maintain that the bold theories regarding complete intellectual freedom and the enfranchisement from all rules whatever, which are expounded by the most advanced adepts of the short path, are the faint echo of teachings that existed from time immemorial in Central and Northern Asia. The Lama was convinced that these doctrines agree completely with the Buddha's highest teaching as it was made evident in various passages of his discourses. However, said the Lama, the Buddha was well aware that the majority do better to abide by rules devised to avert the baleful effects of their ignorance and guide them along paths where no disasters are to be feared. For that very reason, the all-wise master has established rules for the laity and monks of average intelligence. The same Lama who entertained serious doubts as to the Aryan origin of the Buddha. He rather believed that his ancestors belonged to the yellow race and was convinced that his expected successor, the future Buddha Maitreya, would appear in northern Asia. Where did he get these ideas? I have not been able to find out. Discussion is hardly possible with Oriental mystics. When once they have answered, I have seen this in my meditations, little hope is left to the inquirer of obtaining further explanations. I have also heard similar ideas expressed by Nyors from Nepal. Their argument was that the native land of the Buddha was their own country. The great sage of India, they said, belonged to the same stock as ourselves. And as for us, we are of the same race as the Chinese. It is, of course, only the learned lamas and mystics who hold the theories just mentioned, regarding the path of the rules and the short path. Now, in Tibet, as elsewhere, scholars and thinkers are few. So while amongst the partisans of the rules the many merely vegetate in the monasteries, the doctrine of complete freedom affords a raison d'etre to countless people scarcely capable of haunting any summit, but whose originality cannot be denied. Most magicians shelter themselves under the flag of the latter party. Not that many of them seek rapid spiritual achievement. That which appeals to them in the short path is freedom from the bondage of discipline and the permission thus granted to proceed with whatever experiments may be useful for their own advancement. The formula is vague enough to allow interpretations that fit all kinds of characters. A broad classification of Tibetan professed magicians and students of the magic art divides them into two categories. The first includes all those who do not seek direct mastery over nature, but only the power of coercing certain gods and demons to secure their help. The men who practice that method believe in the real existence of the beings of the other worlds as entities completely distinct from them. They also think that their own ability and power are much inferior to those of the personalities whom they endeavor to enslave, and that they would be incapable of obtaining the results which they expect from the latter's help by their own efforts. Again, whatever other means they use, spells, charms, etc., they also implicitly recognize that their active power, though put into motion by the man who uses them, does not emanate from him. In the second category, only a small number of adepts are to be reckoned. These employ, at times, the very same means as their less enlightened colleagues, but they do it for different reasons. They hold the view that the various phenomena which the vulgar consider as miracles, are produced by an energy arising in the magician himself and depend on his knowledge of the true inner essence of things. Most of them are men of retired habits, even hermits, who do not exhibit any singularity in their ways and appearance. They make no attempt to exhibit their powers and often remain entirely unknown. On the contrary, the magicians of the first group are fond of indulging in many kinds of showy and bewildering eccentricities. Sorcerers, soothsayers, necromancers, occultists from the meanest beggarly class to those of high social standing, can be met with among them. A lover of odd discourses and deeds may enjoy himself listening to the theories regarding integral freedom and its practice that are current in such society. But behind these absurd extravagances there are elements of knowledge regarding old traditions, forgotten history and the handling of psychic forces to be gleaned. But in these circles, as elsewhere in Tibet, the great difficulty is to gain a footing. It is unnecessary to be an ordained monk to enter the short path to deliverance. According to its adepts, only initiations are of value. So any layman, if recognized as fit to undertake the spiritual climbing, may be accepted by a mystic master and in due time initiated by him. The same rule applies to students of magic. Nevertheless, most mystics and magicians have begun their career as youths in the religious order. The choice of the master who is to guide him along the mystic path, arduous and fraught with deceitful mirages, is a momentous decision for the candidate to initiation. The course which his life will follow depends to a great extent upon the character of the Lama he elects. For having asked admittance at a door from which they ought to have turned away, some have met with fantastic adventures. Yet, if the young monk is satisfied with begging the spiritual guidance of a Lama who is neither an anchorite nor an extremist of the short path, his novitiate will probably not include any tragic incidents. During a probation period of undetermined length, the master will test the character of his new disciple. Then he may simply explain some philosophical treatises and the meaning of a few symbolic diagrams, teaching him the methodic meditations for which they are used. If the Lama thinks his pupil capable of proceeding farther, he will expound him the program of the mystic training. The latter includes three stages, namely, tawa, to look, examine, gompa, to think, meditate kayadpa, to practice, realize. This is the fruit of accomplishment through the two former stages. Another less current enumeration makes use of four terms to convey the same meaning, as follows. First stage, tun, meaning, reason. That is to say, investigation of the nature of things, their origin, their end, the causes upon which they depend. Lop, study of various doctrines. Second stage, gam, thinking or meditating on that which one has discovered and learned. Practicing introspective meditation. Third stage, togs, understanding. In order that the novice may practice in perfect quietness the various exercises which that program requires, it is nearly certain that the Lama will command him to shut himself in tsams. The word tsams signifies a barrier, the border of a territory. In religious parlance, to stay in tsams means to live in seclusion, to retire beyond a barrier which must not be passed. That barrier may be of different kinds. With advanced mystics it becomes purely psychic, and it is said that the latter need no material contrivances to isolate themselves while meditating. There exist several categories of tsams, each one being subdivided into a number of varieties. Proceeding from the less austere towards the most severe forms, we find the following ones. A Lama or a lay devotee shuts himself in his room or private apartment. He does not go out, or only does so at fixed time, to perform some devotional practices such as walking around religious edifices, making repeated prostrations before sacred objects, or the like. According to the rule which he has adopted, the tsamspa either may be seen or must remain invisible. In the first case, he is generally permitted to talk briefly with the members of the household, his relatives or servants, and even to receive a few visitors. In the second case, he may only be seen by those who attend him. If a visitor is admitted, he must remain within hearing outside the tsamspa's room. A curtain screens the entrance, and the interlocutors remain invisible to each other, as in some Roman Catholic contemplative orders of nuns. A number of Tibetans resort occasionally to one or another of these mild forms of seclusion for non-religious motives, seeking merely to avoid disturbance while engaged in the study of any branch of Tibetan learning, grammar, philosophy, astrology, medicine, etc. Next comes the recluse who sees but one attendant. He who renounces speaking and makes known his needs by writing. He who partly covers his window, so that he cannot see the surrounding landscape, nor any outside object except the sky. He who renounces the sight of the sky, covering his window entirely, or living in a windowless room which, nevertheless, admits the daylight indirectly. He who sees no one at all. In this case, if the tsamspa enjoys the use of a suite of rooms, his meals are brought into one of them, while he retires into another. When he lives in a single room, food is placed next the entrance. Someone knocks at the door to inform the recluse that what he needs is ready, and then the inmates of the house leave the adjacent room or corridors for a moment to allow the tsamspa to come out without being seen. Any object is returned in the same way, the tsamspa calling attention by knocking at the door or ringing a bell. Among those who practice this particular kind of tsams, some ask by writing for the things which they require, but others renounce this facility. Consequently, whatever may be their needs, they cannot make them known. Even if those who attend on them forgot to give them their meal, they ought to fast in silence. Generally, tsams in one's own house do not last long, especially of the strict kind. 1 year seems to be an exceptional period. One usually hears of people who live in seclusion for 3 months, 1 month and even a few days only. Laymen rarely shut themselves in their apartment for more than 1 month. It is easy to understand that prolonged and severe tsams cannot be practiced in an ordinary residence. There, whatever care is taken, the moving about of people busy with worldly affairs and the noise inevitably reach the tsamspa, through the thin barrier of his closed door. The silence and quiet surroundings which may be enjoyed to a high degree in the monasteries are not even deemed sufficient by some, and many gompas own special small houses built for the use of their members who wish to live in strict seclusion. These houses are called tsamskang. They are sometimes situated in an out-of-the-way spot, inside the monastery's walls, but more frequently stand aloof on some hill, at a little distance outside the walled enclosure. It is not unusual to find groups of these meditation houses standing in the solitude, at a few days' march from their parent monastery. The plans of the tsamskangs correspond to the various rules and requirements here above mentioned. From the windows of some of them, the recluse may end of the sight of beautiful landscapes, while others are surrounded by walls that cut off the view on all sides. In that case, the enclosure often forms a small courtyard or terrace where the tsamspa may sit or walk in the open, without being seen, or himself seeing anything of the outside world. Most tsamskangs are divided into two rooms. In one of them, the recluse sits and sleeps. The other one is the kitchen in which an attendant may live. When the tsampa must see no one and keep the rule of silence, his attendant lives in a separate hut. A double wicket is then built in the wall or the door of the recluse's room, and through it meals are given to him. Solid food is generally served only once a day, but buttered tea is brought several times. If the lama belongs to one or another of the red cap sects, beer alternates with the tea. Tibetans having the custom of keeping a small bag of barley flour at hand, the recluse is at liberty to eat some with his tea or beer, whenever he likes. Only members of the religious order attire in the cottages specially built to be used as meditation houses. Some remain in seclusion during several consecutive years. A canonic period is 3 years, 3 months, 3 weeks and 3 days. Some repeat that long retreat twice or thrice in the course of their life, and a few shut themselves in tsams for life. There exists a still more austere form of tsams, that of dwelling in complete darkness. Meditation in darkness is not a practice peculiar to Lamaism. It is known in all Buddhist countries. I have seen different kinds of rooms in Burma, specially built for the purpose, and made use of them myself during my stay on the Sagain Hills. But while Burmese and other Buddhist monks only spend a few hours at a time there, certain Tibetan ascetics bury themselves for years, and even till death, in such grave-like dwellings. However, these extreme cases are rare. When complete night is desired and the sojourn in the tsamskang is to be long, the latter is often established in a grotto or a partly underground building, ventilated by chimneys constructed in such a way that they do not allow the light to penetrate into the recluse's cell. This, however, is very seldom done. Usually the dark hermitage is aerated in a natural, and, indeed, very imperfect, way, through fissures and the like. Though these must, perforce, admit some light together with air. That light seems often of a purely theoretical kind, for in some of these obscure abodes it is impossible to distinguish any object. Yet, after a time, the eyes of the tsamspas get accustomed to dark, and succeed in vaguely seeing their surroundings. According to what I have heard from men who have spent long periods of seclusion in darkness, these hermits enjoy, at times, wonderful illuminations. Their cell becomes bright with light or, in the darkness, every object is drawn with luminous outlines, or again, a phantasmagoria of shining flowers, landscapes and personages arises before them. Optic phenomena of that kind are certainly common, for they have also been described to me in Burma, by bhikkhus who practiced meditation in darkness, and I suppose that everybody has seen something of the kind at night. Tibetans see in this a way of testing the degree of fixity attained by the mind. The kaleidoscopic mirage is considered by them as entirely subjective. It is, they think, caused by the uncontrolled agitation of the mind. When the latter is brought near stillness, the phantasmagoria vanishes. There remains only a spot which may be either dark-colored or like a diminutive globe of light. At first that spot moves and the aim of the practice is to fix it. The stage in which the spot remains motionless, without undergoing any change in size, color, etc., is the moment when the mystic is able to concentrate his thoughts on any object he chooses without any other ideas breaking his one-pointedness of mind. The next stage is marked by the disappearance of the spot which sinks in utter darkness. This, however, is not always attained. Many continue to proudly enjoy the fairy scene, thinking that they have obtained a glimpse of paradise. Besides recreations of this kind, a number of subtler enchantments await the Tsamspa in his hermitage. These, according to religious teachers, are traps which catch the unintelligent disciple who ventures on the mystic path. When the Tsamspa, who has spent a long time in darkness, is nearing the end of his retreat, he gradually accustoms his eyes to see the daylight again. For that purpose, a hole, the size of a pin's head, is pierced in a mud part of the wall and is enlarged each day till the aperture forms a small window. This operation may take several months and is either done by the recluse himself or by another person, his guru or a friend. The longer the time spent in obscurity, the slower is the admission of light into the cell. Novices who shut themselves up entirely for the first time, either in light or dark tsamskangs, generally receive instructions from their guru during their seclusion. The Lama speaks to them from outside, through the double wicket which is used to pass in the recluse's meal. The guru of a Tsamspa who must see nobody, often shuts the entrance of the latter's cell with his own seal. A religious ceremony is performed on that occasion and another one when the master breaks the seal and the recluse steps out. If the Tsams is not of the severe kind, a flag may be placed at the recluse's door, on which are written the names of the persons who are allowed to enter his rooms, attendants or visitors allowed by the Tsamspa's teacher. A dry branch is sometimes driven in the earth or stuck in a pot, near the hermitage of a Tsamspa who shuts himself up for life. The term Tsamskang is more generally applied to meditation, cottages built in the vicinity of a monastery. Those standing in more remote places are called Ritod. Ritods are never built at the bottom of a valley, they are always perched on a dominating spot, and the choice of the site is made in accordance with special rules. Two well-known Tibetan verses depict the main conditions required. Jayabritag, Dunritso. The mountain rock, behind. The mountain lake in front. That is to say that the hermitage should be built on the hillside with a background of rocks, or better still against the rock itself, looking down on a lake or, at least, a stream. Various other regulations have been laid down, in accordance with the requirements of peculiar spiritual and psychic trainings. Thus, some dwellings must permit an extended view so that the anchorite can see the sun rising and setting. The noises produced by running water or wind must be muffled as far as possible. The vicinity of woodland is advised or a barren landscape deemed more suitable, etc. Ritadpas do not remain continually shut in their houses. Outside the periods of strict tsams, most of them go out between the hours which they devote to meditation or other practices. According to the rule imposed by their guru, or self-imposed, they are either allowed, or forbidden, to talk with their neighbors while fetching water, collecting fuel or taking a walk around their cabin. Meditation in the open is sometimes advised by the Ritadpa's spiritual guide or some practice it from their own inclination. Though the term Ritod, properly speaking, means a group of hermitages, current usage applies it to all single isolated anchorite abodes, huts or caves. It is to such primitive dwellings far away from inhabited regions, that staunch Naljorpas who aim at climbing the rugged rocks of spiritual heights, retire. Those who are still at the novice stage, tramp 8 long intervals to their guru's place to tell him about their psychic experiences, the ideas to which their meditation have given birth, and also to receive his advice and communication of spiritual power. Several years may elapse between such meetings. As for the hermits who are teachers, some of them allow few promising beginners to live in their vicinity. Vicinity is, however, a wide term. The disciple may stay on the same hill as his master at a spot situated lower down than the latter's dwelling, or at 1 or 2 days' march. One can well imagine that all of the many Tsams, Kangs and Ritods dwellers are not saints or sages. False presence and sham mysticism have long ago crept into the world of Tibetan anchorites. Even on the shining snowy ranges, one can meet the hypocrite. Under the guise of Gomchans, boasting of secret knowledge and supernormal powers, they deceive simple-minded peasantry or tent-dwelling herdsmen. It may appear to a Westerner that they pay dearly for the material advantages or the fame they enjoy, by purchasing them at the cost of the hardships of hermit life. But one must appreciate the bargain from a Tibetan, and not from a Western, point of view. Tibetans are a strong and sturdy people. The cold, sleeping on the ground in the open, solitude, and many other things from which the average Westerners would shrink, do not frighten them in the least. There are but a few of them, even among the upper classes, who have not experienced something of the kind whilst traveling or on other occasions. Adventurous clerical charlatans, often illiterate and of poor parentage, who cannot expect any standing in their monastery, enjoy a much more agreeable life in a Ritod than they could hope for elsewhere. The more ambitious among them may, indeed, submit to uncommon austerities, in order to gain repute, but they give up all these after a few years, when their fame is sufficiently well established. Then, they may settle in some private abode, relying on the gifts of the laity to enable them to spend their days in comfort. Others make no attempt at calling attention to themselves. They merely settle down in a cabin or a cave conveniently situated at a few miles from a prosperous village or herdsman's tribal ground. Things may be a little hard at first and food not always plentiful, for Tibetans are not hasty in giving their confidence and faith to uncommissioned lamas. But if the man is clever and knows the ways, he will gradually succeed. He must play the soothsayer, of course, and drive away the demons which cause illness. If chance favors him, a few of the oracles he delivers may prove true. Man or beast recover after he has exorcised the evil one. Nothing more is needed to secure quite brilliant prospects. I suppose that few Westerners would enjoy the life of a pseudo-ascetic in the Tibetan wilds, but Tibetans do. Frauds of this kind always end by being caught at their own tricks. Of course, they do not attain the bliss which awaits true mystics, but they live free, respected, without any occasion for working, and they receive enough tea, butter, and sampa for all their daily wants. Beyond this, any cabin or cave roughly fitted up as a dwelling place satisfies the unsophisticated craving of these ingenious, yet simple, rogues. Many of them are far from being bad characters and altogether unsympathetic. They nearly always struck me as practical jokers, and the fun I derived from their naive cunning inclined me to kindly judgment. The current idea in the West is that a man cannot maintain seclusion or absolute solitude for a considerable length of time. It is believed that these unavoidably bring in their drain, brain disorders, finally leading to stupidity and madness. This is perhaps true about the individuals on whom the effects of isolation have been studied: lighthouse guards, travelers thrown onto desert island after a shipwreck, explorers lost in uninhabited regions, prisoners in solitary confinement, etc. But such observations do not apply to Tibetan hermits. The latter, after 10 or 20 years, or even a longer time, in the wilderness or in Tsams Kangs, are far from being insane. One may dispute the theories which they have conceived during their protracted meditations, but it is impossible to question their sanity. There is nothing really remarkable about this. These men are prepared for loneliness. Before shutting themselves in their Tsams Kang or settling in a Ritod, they have accumulated in their mind a store of ideas which keep them company. Moreover, they are not inactive during their retreat, long as it may be. Their days are occupied by methodical exercises in spiritual training, the search for occult knowledge or meditations on philosophic problems.